You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Well, welcome everyone to our first member event, New York City Youth Funders member event. I'm Roderick Jenkins, and I'm a program officer with the New York Community Trust. I also am co-chair of the New York City Youth Funders Network with my co-chair, Dara Rose from the Wallace Foundation. So it's my job just to give you a bit of a background about the Youth Funders Network. But first, let me thank Sean for hosting this event and for the wonderful food. Yes, round of applause. It's a great room. You set up the tables. So thank you for coming. The Youth Funders Network was formed about 19 years ago. We've been around for a while in different forms, by a group of foundation executives who care about kids and want to see better outcomes for New York City youth. The network has evolved in recent years, and today we're going to show you what we've planned. We have a website planned to show you today, and we want to invite you to not only attend our sessions, but to give us ideas about topics that you want us to host. Basically, our role is to highlight important issues and educate our fellow colleagues in the funding community. That's it for me. I don't have a lot to say. At the Trust, we keep things short. So that's what I'm going to say. I'm going to turn it over to Dara. And after Dara, Sean's going to get up and introduce our panel of speakers. It's a timely issue, and I'm sure it's going to be of interest to everyone. Thank you.
Yep.
Before the website, before you.
So I'd just like to add a few more details. The New York City Youth Funders Network is an affinity group of Philanthropy New York. We are volunteer-run, with the exception of our fearless coordinator, Janet Kelly, who really makes a lot of stuff happen for us. But we really rely on the volunteer efforts of our steering committee, which are volunteer funders, as well as just our general membership for, like Roderick said, suggesting ideas and also taking the lead for organizing events with us. And the events are often panel discussions, can be brown bag lunches about topics of relevance or about our own practice and philanthropic strategies. We haven't done a lot of that in terms of really kind of presenting a challenge or a strategy that we're doing personally in our own foundations, but certainly that's something that we've been talking about being more critical and collective in our discussion of our practice. So I welcome you to learn more about us and to work with us. And Leslie is going to debut. This is our website. We've never had a website before, so this is a big day. We go live. And following that, Sean will introduce the speakers. And again, it's an informal day, so I would just encourage you to ask questions and comments throughout Leslie's presentation and then during the remarks by our guest speakers. And then we'll just open it up for more networking. So thank you all for joining us this afternoon. Leslie.
Yeah. So this is it. It's been a while in coming, but our homepage, nycyouthfunders.org, is how you'll be able to find us. We're not quite live, but expect us very soon. And the idea is to, through our website, to help us connect with other funders who are interested in children and youth in New York City, and to help them connect with our affinity group, and also to help people who have already joined our group. Membership is free. To get an update on our upcoming events. Things are often timely and happen with short notice. So aside from email blasts, you can come to our website, learn more about an event, click on, here to register. And also, also you can learn a little bit more about us here. There's a brief description and, some words about how we're governed. The Youth Funders is made up of a steering committee of funders and across corporate, private, family, foundations. Also, we welcome philanthropic advisors and members of government who are involved in funding in this area. And so you can get an idea of our growing list of coordinators, and we want to encourage people to get involved. So we welcome your input. We're always looking for suggestions as to the topics we might cover. Forgive me for this clumsy walkthrough. But, you know, we're always interested in hearing from you about what you're interested in, the issues you see that are on the horizon, and how we might help to inform our community more about what's going on and how we might best respond. Again, I want to encourage people, if you're not a registered member but have been attending our events, still take time to just fill out our membership form. This is our way of keeping in touch with individuals, not just a specific foundation. So if there's more than one person who in your office that wants to be invited, we encourage you to fill out the membership form. Also, if you missed a program that we did in the past, or just, you know, forgot to pick up that report that was offered there, you know, we offer links to all of that information. Back in March, we had a very interesting forum on the growing Latino sector of the youth in New York City, and we got a chance to hear from Community Service Society to hear about the report that they had just put out. So we're making that available to our members here. It's an easy way to lighten your load, and you don't have to carry that report back to your office, but you can look at it online. And so that's another service we offer. And under development is our resource page, where we also hope to hear from you and make this a place where the community can share reports, such as the Community Service Society report that I just showed you, to make that available to the community. And let's see, we also have just a description of what it means to be a member. Again, membership is free and easy, so please register and encourage your colleagues who want to be invited to our events to become members. And again, this little pie chart just maps out kind of the breakdown of the areas of philanthropy that our members fall in. And lastly, there is, we do encourage people to consider the value of what we do in bringing the funding community together. It's and it's through the volunteer donations of a growing list of funders that you can see here that our work is possible, and events such as this really come, you know, take shape and happen. So we hope that you'll consider making a contribution, you know, when you can, and one that is appropriate to the size of your organization, certainly. And are there any questions about this? So we hope you'll visit our site often to get updates from us and give us your feedback. Please, we want to hear from you, because this is all about being helping to build community among the philanthropic community. So,
thanks.
Yep.
And just, I would do a round of applause. A moment in the making. When she signed up for that task, I don't think.
Yeah. Well, I can't take all the credit, because the Foundation Center was instrumental in helping us build this site, and as were also my colleagues on the steering committee who played a part in Deborah Velasquez.
We were a very democratic group. We organized our committees.
And Connie.
Deborah Velasquez, you could stand up, please. Foundation.
Connie Brandeis, who couldn't be here today.
So what we try to do with the committee, what we tried to do a couple years ago,
all right. we called Haley in to make sure that she was able to push the button to pull up the screen. Didn't know how to do that. I sent a text. So I was like, I need you in here. And Haley Roberts, for those of you, some of you in the room know who she is. She is the program associate for the Campaign for Black Male Achievement here at the Open Society Foundation. And I just want to welcome everyone. Again, my name is Sean Dove, and I am the campaign manager of the Open Society Foundation's Campaign for Black Male Achievement. And this is actually, we're celebrating our three-year anniversary of the campaign. And many of you, I'm just going to give a brief overview, introduce the panelists, and give them an opportunity to share about their work. Some of you may recall in March of 2006, there was a cover story in the New York Times that proclaimed the plight of black men deepens. And it really brought to light some really distressing data from around the country that showed that while the economy in the turn of the century in the 2000s was really expanding and that there were so many people doing well, but black men and boys were being left behind. The data showed that the graduation rates across the country was below 50% in many cities, and in some cities as low as 19-17% for black boys. The health disparities, the incarceration rates, and it ignited a conversation here at the Open Society Foundations that really asked the question, if we are truly a foundation that is really devoted and committed to empowering communities across the country, the most marginalized population, why aren't we at the front end of this issue? And there was a debate. Some folks on the foundation said, well, we are engaged in supporting black men and boys directly. Look at the amount of money we're investing in our criminal justice fund. And this was an opportunity for the foundation to invest in the front end of the prison pipeline. And so I'm just really ecstatic that I work at a foundation where we have a risk-taking living donor in George Soros that saw fit for us to have a campaign for black male achievement. We launched it, and we're focusing in three core areas of educational equity, increasing living wage work opportunities, and strengthening family structures. And so we are not the only foundation engaged specifically in this work. I really have to lift up the 21st Century Foundation, Sean and Sietu in the back. The 21st Century Foundation and the Ford Foundation really in from 2004, 5 and 6 to 8 really put this issue on the philanthropic map. So we want to thank them for their leadership. And I think, you know, what we're going to talk about today is what can philanthropy do around this issue? What are some promising practices? And I think one of the key things that philanthropy can do and what the campaign is committed to is keeping this issue front and center on the political, philanthropic, and public policy debate, that there is a crisis in our country around black men and boys, and that we won't allow philanthropy to be fickle around this issue right now because we have to do something. So there has to be a sustained intent. Also, with the campaign and what philanthropy can do is really cultivate philanthropic partnerships like we see right here in this room, strengthen the capacity of fragile organizations that are committed to this work and building leadership and capacity, and measuring and promoting what works. And so that's at the heart of what we're going to do today and talk about what works. So this is an informal gathering, although we are taping. And so we decided to tape it and podcast it in chance that someone may say something really profound and earth-shattering that we won't say that we missed it. We can document it and put it up on our website. And so the bios of the speakers are in your folders, and I know each of the speakers in different ways, and I want to ask Andrea Batista Schlesinger to come up first, who is a special advisor to the mayor, and come have a seat. Why are you looking at me? You're not going to speak first. You're coming up and you're sitting down.
$20 and no fun. I'll give you $40.
Well, and you actually, you never gave it to me. You just promised it, so that deal never really. Richard Bury, CEO of the Children's Aid Society. We're going to invite Richard up. And David Banks, President and CEO of the Eagle Academy Foundation. So this is how it's going to work. We're going to ask each of the panelists to take no more than 5 minutes to provide a brief overview of their work, and specifically what initiatives and impact that they are having in supporting black boys and boys of color in New York City. And then we're going to open it up for some questions and conversation between the moderator and the audience. How does that work? Okay, so Richard, we're going to start with you.
I said I'd give you 40.
All these promises.
good evening, everyone. How are you?
And use the mic.
I'm sorry. Good evening. So I will not be the one to say something profound, but hopefully David will be will do that for us. Rich Bury from the Children's Aid Society. It's good to meet you all, and I will give I'll speak very briefly, give an overview of some of our work, and look forward to having a good conversation. So, as folks here know, at Children's Aid, we provide a wide array of services. And so a wide array of services in terms of the ages that we serve. We begin our work as early as working with pregnant moms to early childhood services, young people and adolescents and young adults, but also a wide range of services in terms of the risk factors experienced by the children that we serve. So everything from traditional youth development programs for children in stable families to intensive interventions for families who are severely at risk, things like foster care or reentry programs for juveniles coming home. And of course, as you can imagine, in these programs, we serve a variety of backgrounds, including a large proportion of African American men. So I think when we think about our work, we find in our organization that because the needs of families and children can be so complex and so deep, one advantage that we have as an organization is that within the Children's Aid Society, we have a variety of strategies and resources that we can bring to bear for young people at risk. Health services, educational services, counseling and mental health, dental, financial advising, literacy, public benefits access, and counseling. So we find that we have lots of resources that we can bring to bear on behalf of young people who have a variety of problems and challenges and needing solutions. But we also know in a complex organization like this, one of the central challenges can be figuring out how do you organize these services effectively on behalf of young people over time in the sustained ways that lead to long-term results. So a few years ago, before I came to Children's Aid, looking at the challenges, and I won't repeat any of the statistics because you all know them better than I do, but looking at the particular challenges faced by young men in New York City and the horrible outcomes, educational, social, that those young people were achieving, Children's Aid really wanted to think about what we might be able to do differently and how we could bring all these assets to bear in a way that was focused and concerted on behalf of African-American men, and we created something called the African-American Male Initiative. And the showpiece of that program is something called Steps to Success. And really looking at research on best practices, but also looking at our experience with best practices, what we developed is a model where we started with a cohort, three cohorts at the time, second, third, and fourth grade boys, about 15 boys in each cohort. And at the centerpiece of this model is life coaching, where we have a professional adult black male staff person who serves as a life coach for the young people in that cohort. And the life coaches plays multiple roles. For one, of course, they are an emergency resource. When crises come up, one of their jobs is to help families and children avert crises. But more than that, they are mentors to young people. They are, I think of it as orchestra conductors. They orchestrate resources. So based on where a child is experiencing, what their strengths are and what their needs are, part of their job is to look within and without the agency to figure out how to coordinate services effectively for that young person. They help the child and the family set positive goals and keep the goals every year. So what are the child going to achieve academically and socially? And around this life coaching is a variety of traditional youth and development experience, arts, culture, academic enrichment, et cetera. And it's a small program. It's a pilot program. We've really seen some fantastic results. 3 years in, all the young people in that program have progressed on time. No one's been left back. Young people have markedly higher levels of school attendance and school participation. So we're starting to see some positive outcome that we've made a lifelong, we've made a commitment to these young people to stay with them until they graduate from school. Life coaching is something that we do in our African American Male Initiative, but it's a strategy that we've used in other of our programs as well, in various parts of our child welfare work, in our juvenile justice work, also built around providing life coaches to young people reentering the community. And as an organization, we really feel like this strategy, which in some ways we incubated working with a particular population, we feel like this strategy of providing long-term professional mentoring and life coaching to vulnerable young people over a long period of time, from the time they enter programs to the time they leave, focus on a particular set of outcomes, which for us, the ultimate of those outcomes being college graduation. We really feel that this strategy can have a transformative impact in the way we serve children. And moving forward, based on what we've learned with black males in this pilot program, we're hoping to expand that approach and expand that model to be the core of how we serve the most vulnerable young children in our services of whatever race and gender moving forward. So I look forward to having a dialogue more about that work and hearing from my co-panelists. So I think that was exactly 5 minutes.
And turn over to David Banks, President and CEO of Eagle Academy Foundation and founder of Eagle Academy.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Sean. Good evening, everyone. And first of all, just want to thank everyone who had a say in putting all this together and the website. And everybody just really just committed to this issue. And particularly wanted to say a special acknowledgement really to Sean for his work here at OSI, what he's been doing by keeping this issue really on the front burner. It really is. It's an issue that could very easily be disregarded. And it's a population of young people that heretofore have, in many ways, been disregarded. And so I salute you and thank you for keeping this issue out there on the forefront. I head up the Eagle Academy Foundation. We have created a network of all boys schools here in New York City. I was the founding principal of the original school in the Bronx, which was the first all male public high school in New York in 30 years. And the school is doing extremely well. I had an 87% graduation rate last year in a city that is still just hovering over 50% in terms of graduation rate for that particular population. Just very, very excited about the work that we're doing. We're continuing to expand on our model. We're in Ocean Hill, Brownsville, and in Southeast Queens. And thrilled to tell you all tonight that in 2012 we'll be opening our fourth school in Newark, New Jersey, and the tremendous needs that they have really in that community as well. But this really started as a response to this crisis here in New York City. And in New York City, there was a criminal justice report that was released several years ago that said that over 70% of the inmates for New York State, the entire state, come from seven very specific neighborhoods in New York City. And when you just think about that on its face, that's very profound. And so I would offer you as a profound statement that I'm a black male who still cares, because we have so many of our people who are out here who are overwhelmed and just grasping at anything to try and figure out how do we save the lives of black men and black boys, and that is the work that we are so deeply engaged in. We've developed a very kind of comprehensive model that we think takes into account a lot of the best research that's been out there for years. How do you engage parents? We've got a very, very extensive parental engagement plan in place, and our parents were very involved. Our academic approach, very, very focused on how do you engage males. In some of our best schools in New York City and around the country, when you disaggregate the data, African-American Latino males, oftentimes they don't, the needle is still not moving on that particular population, even in our, even in some of our better schools. And so we figured out some things in terms of how to engage that population. It's a college-going program, and we expect for all of our young men to graduate, and they're all encouraged to go off to colleges around the country. We engage them in after-school programs, and all of our students are required to be in schools on Saturdays for an additional 3 to 4 hours. A whole host of rituals that we put in place that kind of capture the spirit of what it means to be a young man. Just this on this coming Saturday, we'll be welcoming in our incoming class of ninth graders, as well as for the first time in the Bronx, our incoming class of sixth graders. Because I think the number one lesson that we've learned since we started this process is that if we want to be really successful, much like Rich is talking about, you got to get them earlier. Starting at the ninth grade is it's either too late or it's just really, really hard. And so our school in Brooklyn and Queens and then now Newark will all start with younger ages. And so the earlier that we can get them, the better. Former Chancellor Joel Klein used to kid me and say, at some point we're just going to start hanging out in maternity wards and just grab them right from there, because you know we're only playing around a little bit on the margins. It's that serious, and the decline starts really very early on. And I think finally we've got a very comprehensive mentoring program, putting men in the lives of young men. When we created the school, we thought that it would be a good thing to do. We had no idea just how profoundly impactful it would be engaging men and getting them involved in the lives of young men. And so this coming September, we will have over 1,000 students between our three schools. And our plan is to do at least 7 schools in New York City and do a few schools in the city of Newark. We will be working with over 6,000 to 7,000 young men in direct service in our schools. And beyond that, I think even more impactful, the work that we are currently engaged in, which is our professional development work to work with to support other schools working with young men. Everyone won't be able to go to an Eagle Academy, but how can we actually reach out and be even more impactful in working with young men and teaching other schools how to do this? And so the work has been national. When we opened, we were the first one of its school of its kind. Now there are over 30 which have opened during the last 5 years. We've created a national organization called the Coalition of Schools Educating Boys of Color. You can find them on the website as well, COSBOC. And so this is a movement that has started. The work that we're engaged in at Eagle Academy is really a leadership role. And so I welcome the opportunity to further the discussion with you today. Thank you.
Thanks, David. And in his State of the City address in 2010, Mayor Bloomberg announced that he wanted to do something that was targeted and focused for young men of this city. And then Andrea Batista Schlesinger was brought on to lead a robust planning process. And so she is working very closely in the basement of City Hall. We've let her out for this particular panel presentation.
Seen the sun in days.
Just to get some food and to see the sun. And we're going to ask her to share what she can at this juncture of those plans.
Thanks, Sean. I was going to do a thank you to Sean, but now that you teased me about working out of the basement of City Hall, I'm going to skip that. Just kidding. Thanks to Sean. Thank you for being susceptible to bribery in terms of the order of opening speakers. So first, I am going to speak specifically about this initiative that the mayor launched, but I just wanted to say that the total of the mayor's efforts focused on improving outcomes of young men of color is not represented only by this initiative. For example, you know, just here we have both DYCD, which is a pioneering agency thinking about how to serve young men, disconnected youth, young people, and the Mayor's Center for Economic Opportunity, which is an incredible R&D lab, and all of you know this, but that is unprecedented in terms of thinking about what are the programs that actually work to change people's lives, and then how do we make sure to invest only in those and efforts that don't work. So This initiative is a complement to those things that have already been underway. So as Sean said, you know, the mayor was frustrated, and I will tell you, you know, between us, sometimes things that we say were the mayor's idea were actually other people's ideas. And in this case, this was actually the mayor's idea. I won't tell you what those things are specifically that actually weren't the mayor's idea, but I'll just tell you that this one this specifically was the mayor's idea, in particular because he had a very strong concern and passion for thinking about how we break the cycle of incarceration for young men of color. And this issue of recidivism and juvenile justice reform is one where he's really... Is that him? I didn't mean it. So the mayor launched this initiative in his State of the City and appointed two very esteemed New Yorkers to be co-chairs. And I'm not just saying that because one of them is sitting here, but David Banks is a co-chair along with Ana Oliveira, and he tasked two deputy mayors with coming back to him with concrete recommendations for how we can actually move the needle when it comes to how young men of color are faring in New York City. The first thing that we undertook was to do some data and find out, although we take for granted and you know, we talk loosely about the statistics, you know, it actually was hard to come up with numbers that hadn't previously been cut mm-hmm. by race and by gender, to find out, you know, how many, when we talk about boys in the school-to-prison pipeline, how many boys really are suspended, what is the connection between that and imprisonment, you know, what how are people and boys in particular really faring? And so that was the first step, and we put together a very interesting data set that at some point we'll be able to share that speaks to the urgency of this work. The next part of the process was to think about what's the unique role that the city government can play. You know, we're not a foundation. We're not an organization. We're not a school. We're not in the position to program our way out of a crisis of this scope. What's the unique role? What unique levers does the city government have available to it to address this crisis? So that was the next piece. And what we came up with was, you know, first, policy. What do we need to do in terms of, and what can we do, using, again, the power that we have as a city government to address big picture policy challenges that are perpetuating, or just missing opportunities to address the situation? That was one. Two is, how are our city agencies interacting with it? I mean, it's not like our city agencies need to go and find boys of color to serve. They are. The issue is, are those boys better off for the interaction or worse? And so how can we look at our own city agencies and think about how they interact, serve, and what kind of outcomes they get for young men of color? And the third, and it's not a coincidence that these things all start with P, but it was really quite nice for PowerPoint purposes, policy, practice, and program, thinking about, yeah, I don't know, whatever. It's Wednesday night. So thinking about programmatic investments, how can we do some really targeted investments that will not be of the scale to match the scope of the scale of the challenge, but that can teach us some things that our agencies can learn that can be translated into reform, into systems reform? So those are the three prongs. And as Sean alluded, we haven't done a big, you know, we've been working hard at this. David worked tremendously hard. So our counterparts outside, as well as the two deputy mayors, one deputy mayor now became the chancellor. You know, a lot of agencies have been on deck, several planning meetings with high-level commissioners and so on. So there's a whole lot of commitment around this, a whole lot of work. We haven't done the public announcement yet, but I do want to give an example of one thing that we did launch that gets to this issue. You know, very early on, we realized that we needed to address father absence if we wanted to get at how we break the cycle and improve outcomes for young men of color. So we, you know, instead of taking kind of a finger-wagging approach of, you know, men just need to be more involved in the lives of their kids, okay, we've asked ourselves the question, if there are men, and really we're talking about low-income men here who want to be involved, what barriers do they encounter when they want to navigate city agencies, when they want to navigate city government? We have a social service net and network that is designed basically to support women. And so, and obviously an important history to that, but today, what are the barriers? So we got about a dozen agencies together and said, look at your practices, think about where you are perhaps inadvertently creating barriers for men who want to be involved in the lives of their kids, or missing opportunities
to better connect men, create more moments between men and their kids, and provide more more resources so that men can have the capacity to be better dads. Agencies came up with their plans. This initiative launched. We hired for the first time a fatherhood services coordinator who started in September. Tomorrow, I invite all of you, if you haven't already been invited, to our first annual Dads Matter Awards, where the mayor is going to present awards to 10 low-income dads who have overcome challenges to be consistent, positive forces in the lives of their kids. But more importantly, we're going to release a one-year progress report, which will give you a real good sense of how every agency has internalized this and is coming up with incredible ideas for how they're actually going to reach out to dads. Last thing, because Rich upped the ante with actually staying to 5 minutes, and I know I've already gone over. That was not cool.
Sorry. The challenge was too much for me.
I mean, if you did it, but then you had to say you did.
Well, so it didn't matter if I don't get credit for it.
That's true.
She's the head of this.
Now, I just wanted to say some of the challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay, or you want me to wait on that?
No, you can
ask about that?
Yeah, I think you've kind of scratched all the questions I had for you during your presentation.
Should I go?
No, you can stay. And actually, I'm going to start. I'm going to start with you. And I just have a couple questions, and we want to have some time to open up for a conversation.
But are you going to ask me about challenges?
No, I'm not going to ask you about challenges
okay.
yet. But you had the three P's that looked really good on a mm-hmm. PowerPoint of policy, practice, and program. And I'm going to ask you, and I'm actually going to ask all the panelists to talk about a fourth P that's hopefully allowing you to move this work. What are the key partnerships that you are engaged in or seeking to ignite that is going to help you win at this work? And we'll go down the line and actually want to talk about the partnerships in New York City.
Well, for us, I think the partnerships are essential and have been essential in terms of getting around the city, seeing what people are doing that's working, and also listening to partners tell us this is where the city can make a difference. You know, partners who serve young men who are saying, here's how they're interacting with your agencies. Here are the barriers that they are encountering. You know, I mean, that's obviously where we get our, I mean, policymakers always get their best ideas from people who are on the ground actually serving communities. So in terms of theft of ideas, you know, those partnerships have been incredible. I think, you know, from a foundation perspective, you know, we've certainly reached out. For example, Sean, you've been incredibly helpful in pointing us towards best practice. And so that's a partnership that's terrific. And all of the ideas for the programmatic investments that we have are partnerships. They're not, you know, things where money is going to come in and then, you know, and the government is going to single-handedly figure out how to produce better outcomes that it hasn't been able to get heretofore. So I think, you know, for us, the partnerships are critical. I think too often on the other side, when people are building partnerships, they forget the local government.
Mm-hmm.
As a partner, and I think that's a mistake on that side. But we've definitely been trying to, you know, to reach out and to set up those partnerships, not only to get us smarter, but also to actually deliver the services.
Okay, David, can you talk a bit about partnerships as well?
Well, I think that from the foundation standpoint, the partnerships have been really our lifeblood. You know. Just from a programmatic support standpoint, I mean, we've had OSI, you know, as an example, has been a major supporter to us, Robin Hood Foundation, News Corporation, J.P. Morgan Chase, Cummings Foundation, and even 21st Century Foundation, who's here today as well. And just to name a few organizations who I think have real interest in this. And so as you talk about that fourth P, I think philanthropy can play a critical role and, in fact, must play a critical role in, you know, really fortifying these organizations that are out here and really trying to make a difference, you know, in this area. I always contend that, you know, first of all, we're in a global race to the top, right? And the reality is that our country is losing. On all indicators of success, graduation rates. I mean, we're continuing to fall behind many other nations around this world, and that trend cannot continue. But it will continue unless we have a very focused effort on lifting the kind of educational performance of all of our young people. But I suggest that this particular population it's at the bottom of the barrel. And so to the degree that you put strategies and philanthropy or philanthropic support in place to lift, you know, as it's been said, the least of these, it lifts everyone else. I had someone recently ask me, they said, well, you know, some of the policies that are coming out of the Federal Department of Education and Obama and Arne Duncan, you know, it's the whole notion of the rising tide lifts all boats. But the rising tide does not lift the boat that has cement in it. I mean, and so the rising tide essentially swamps that boat. And that is what has been happening with our young men. And we have to be very affirmative in the strategies that we put in place to remove the cement from the boat that is African-American and Latino males. I was a school teacher for 6 years in Brooklyn and in a co-ed school. And I was a founding principal of a high school in the Bronx, co-ed school for 7 years. And when I moved over to be the founding principal of the Eagle Academy, where I served for 4 years, I said after 1 month on the job, I said to my wife, there's a reason that nobody else is doing this. That's meant to be a joke. This is really, really hard work, because you're talking about young men who have internalized the notion that everybody has given up on them. And when you internalize that, the manifestation of that is really ugly, and it's really difficult for those who put themselves in there to be those life coaches, those who put their lives on the line by saying, I'm going to commit myself to working with these young people, and oftentimes don't realize just what they've gotten themselves into. It's really, really tough stuff. And when they're younger, they're lovable, huggable, and cute. But as they get older and they're angry, it becomes a handful. And that is why you have to have very focused, targeted strategies meant to remove that cement. Because once you do, then they're just like everybody else. And that's the kind of support, really, that they deserve.
You know, on partnerships, there's relatively little I can add. I mean, I would only say that, as I said before, the needs experienced by the children we're talking about are extremely complex. The obstacles they face are extremely complex. So in very few circumstances can any one single organization hope to meet these needs in a comprehensive way by themselves. So partnership and collaboration, not just with philanthropy, but also with government provided with other nonprofits, is critical. I think what we sometimes underestimate is how difficult partnership and collaboration is. And on a very basic level, the world is not organized to foster collaboration. You know, early childhood is a completely different world administratively from education, completely separate from health. You have all these silos at every level of government. So things aren't organized to actually facilitate collaboration. And certainly on the ground, when organizations are trying to work together or to work with government, it takes resources to collaborate, to align strategies, to share data. And so folks will often talk about collaboration, including funders, but I think rarely is that matched with the actual resources to help people collaborate to overcome institutional or government silos on the ground. So I do think partnership is central. But partnership is a strategy that takes resources and commitment, and I do think that that gets lost when we think about how can we all work together to get something done for children.
I have a bunch of other questions, but I want to open up the conversation first before I stay too selfish up here and ask all the questions that I have. And we do have, is Haley in here? She's not in here, so we have a mic. Oh, okay, so there's a mic there. You are going to do your best Oprah imitation. although actually, Oprah usually just sits on the stage and she doesn't go through the audience. But if you have...
We didn't know you had that kind of time.
My day's off, you know. any questions, feedback, comments for the panelists?
Can you talk a bit about the challenges or the policy challenges?
Can you hear?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Here.
Well, the reason for the mic is that we're for the podcast, so we can actually hear you.
As I said, we were taping. So the question is, could you discuss some of the policy issues you've identified within the city agencies that you may
try to change, whether they're short-term or middle and long-term, under those kinds of bullets?
So I think, I mean, in terms of the policy work that we are doing as part of this initiative and the agency reform, it's really looking at where the disparities are the greatest and what power do we have in these agencies to do anything about it. Is it a question of changing a policy? Is it a question of an agency focusing on this more intently, like, for example, on the fatherhood issue? It was less about one specific policy that needed to be passed, and it was more about a group that was invisible in too many agencies, not all. For example, DYCD has a fatherhood initiative and have led the way, but in too many agencies practice, there just wasn't visibility, there wasn't a priority, there wasn't attention, and that had consequences. So, I mean, for us, we're looking, I think, at what would be considered to be the five buckets that we probably all agree with. I mean, education, justice, both juvenile and criminal, justice, reform, health, employment, and mentoring, which is a theme that you're hearing from the panel. So those are our five buckets of activity. In terms of, though, I did want to say that from a government perspective, it is difficult because this issue isn't an issue. I mean, it's a population that's struggling for a variety of reasons, and there isn't one policy or program mm-hmm. that will make it go away. So as a policymaker, you know, it is very, it's very difficult to address a challenge of this scope. And I also think it affects that inability to narrow it to one policy or another does affect the relationship, for example, between government and foundations. You know, I've had foundations say, well, are you going to do the systems reform or not? Are you going to do systemic reform or are you not going to do systemic reform? You know, because, I mean, I'm going around pitching this stuff just like everybody else, even though that's not why we're here, obviously.
No.
But, you know, that's...
got to make that announcement.
Yeah, no, we got it on the pre-call. But, you know, the systems change doesn't happen in a linear way. There isn't just that one policy that's all of a sudden mm-hmm. going to make it so that disparity is gone. And so... So we can approach these policy questions, and we have, and figure out how to challenge agencies to do better by this population, which we have. But the process, and going back to this collaboration, it's messy. And I think that's the way that it has to be. Yep.
Any other room?
A little bit of an answer. I was wondering if you've identified anything that can make it easier for young fathers when they go before... Oh, right, the mic. When they go before family court on custody hearings, or they go before family court around arrearages, I'm just wondering, are there any things that you could, easy things you can do to begin to make it easier for young? That was the only.
Yeah. So, for example, on that, you know, HRA over the last year, and they've been doing this for the last couple of years, and particularly over the last year, has launched several programs designed to facilitate the process of adjustments. Adjustments to arrears, modifications. You know, as a local government, we're not responsible for how, fortunately, for how family court does its business. It can be confusing, schizophrenic, custody is here, you know, child support is here. I mean, it can be a very disempowering process. But one of the things that we've been trying to do is, for example, bridge these silos and get agencies all around the city communicating with the Office of Child Support Enforcement that has at its disposal a number of tools that can actually adjust arrears. And so that's an example of, it's not one policy, but through better coordination, the launch of new programs, attention paid, you can get a better result.
Any other questions? We have Toya over here.
So for David and Rich, I wanted to ask a question about the supports that you're providing to parents. When you talk about parent engagement, a lot of these families are dealing with multiple levels of dysfunction and challenge. How do you address that as an educator when that's not necessarily your primary call to action?
Right.
But these young people return home, go to school, return home. It becomes a schizophrenic life.
I can go first. I mean, I think parent engagement is central to our strategy for supporting young people. We know that if young people are in stronger families, they're going to do better. And one of the advantages of a strong life coaching model, that it affords that professional an opportunity to develop a relationship with a child and a family such that we can really understand what their gaps are. As an organization at Children's Aid, we have a variety of resources that we can bring to bear to support family challenges. And I think the key is that it's not one thing. It is individualized based on the needs of a family. So if a family is at risk of homelessness, we have supports to help provide housing stability. If a family needs counseling, we have a variety of strategies and resources that we can provide individual or family counseling or therapy to parents. We have a domestic violence program. We provide support to families experiencing domestic violence, not only the moms and the kids, but also the perpetrators, because we know that many times these families are coming back together. If we want to really break the cycle, we need to get at the roots of what's causing the violence in the men in the first place. Healthcare all down the line. So as well as parent education initiatives, really teaching parents to be advocates, effective advocates in schools with institutions so that they can be better representatives for their children. It's not either or. It doesn't exist in a vacuum. And for us, it is very central to our strategy for supporting children.
We make a pretty significant investment in just in terms of overall parent engagement, if you will. So, you know, we do some things in terms of helping our parents who are really in distress, but a lot of it, that is about connecting and having other partnerships as well with community-based organizations that are really there to help meet their needs. We don't pretend to be the organization that has the answers to every one of the parents' issues. But when our parents do have very specific needs and needs specific supports, they know that we are a place that they can come, and we will find the place for them where they can get those answers. We bring people in all the time. Just a couple of weeks ago, we had Terry Williams in, who's written a book recently about depression in the Black community and how to deal with that and how to address that, and you know, gave every one of our parents a copy of her book, and she offered up, you know, online friendships with everyone, people that really needed that kind of support. That's just one activity that we've had. But we bring our parents together on Saturdays. We have a very strong Saturday culture, so our parents come in very regularly on Saturdays. But I think from the very beginning, when our parents come, we break our parents up into cohorts or houses, much like we do with our students. And so all of our young men become part of a specific house once they come to the school. So we take that large incoming class, and then we break that class down into smaller groups. And then we build a very strong parent culture within those groups. There are two parents who are elected as captains for their particular group, and the group has about 12 to 14 students in it. And so those parents, their job is to stay in contact with all the other parents around what's going on, bringing them in for various activities. Joe Klein visited Eagle maybe 2 years ago, and said he hadn't seen this kind of turnout for a regular parent meeting on a Saturday morning, a school that had about 500 students with 400 families there on a Saturday morning, standing room only. And that's a regular meeting that we do. And I think a big part of the reason for that is, number one, they know that we care. Number two, we have put this system in place that brings our parents in. And I think also just the fact that our parents, they don't choose to send their sons to Eagle Academy because it's another option. You know, I'm considering the music school down the block or the other school that has a focus on the arts. They bring their sons to us because they said when he was younger, he listened to what I said. I'm doing this by myself more often than not. A lot of moms, single moms raising their sons. And now that he's getting older, I'm feeling I'm losing the grip. He no longer is listening to everything that I tell him. I tell him to be in the house at 7 o'clock, and now he comes in at 8, and I'm not quite sure how to deal with that. I'm losing him to the streets. And so they don't bring their sons to us because they're looking for another school choice. They bring their sons because they say, I need you to save his life. That's a very different emotional appeal. It's the reason why we've had thousands of applications for 100 seats, and when you have to turn the parents away who come and show up on the first day, the first 2 weeks, in tears, just hoping that somebody's going to leave and something is going to open up. It's a very it's a very emotional experience that they have, and very strong parent coordinator, you know, put in place by the mayor and the chancellor. But we take it very seriously, and we tell our parents from day one that we expect for you to be involved. You ought to be a partner in this. We're not doing this by ourselves. And the same level of expectation that we put on our young men in a system that does not have high expectations for them, we let them know when you come to this place, there are the highest expectations for you. And mom and dad and parents who are here, the same culture and society that does not have the expectations for you, they think that you really don't care, you're not involved. All of that changes once you're in this place. When that message goes out, when that set of expectations is placed and it's high, and then you support it with people who really care and are committed, it makes all the difference in the world. And that's what we've been trying to do.
Other questions? Charles?
So maybe, obviously, the reason we're all here is to talk about what is, you know, long-term and generational...
Excuse me. Goals and you know, dramatic shifts in what we think of as success long term. Given that, and all the funders in the room obviously wrestle with this too, because we all have these long term aspirational goals, right? The Tiger Foundation, who I represent, has a mission of breaking the cycle of poverty in New York City, right? That's as long term as it gets. So I would love to hear you all talk a little bit about kind of what you think about in the way of, say, 12-month goals that are good predictors of success as you think about sort of steps towards, you know, the bigger, longer-term strategies?
Would like to take a dive at that first? I mean, Olive.
I mean, are you saying 12 months is long-term?
12 months, 24 months, you just sort of more generally, what are sort of the most important kind of short-term predictors as you see them across your agency's organizations or from a policy standpoint. You know, we know the ultimate goal is to play out here. There are a lot of things we get there. I'll feel good about the next year if I accomplish, say, these things. So whether it's...
mean for individual children?
Yeah, individual children or organizationally. So, you know, David, maybe the school, sort of what does success look like for the coming school year, you know, in addition to what we're talking about, the broader goal that we all obviously are striving for?
Right. Well, I mean, from our standpoint, on a very basic level, I mean, we're pushing every day. We want every one of our young people to graduate and to go on to college and to be college ready, right? That is a process. So, you know, over the next year or two, I just want to continue to see our numbers continue to increase in terms of our young people continuing to do well in school and I want to see significant increase each year as we're graduating these young people and sending them off to colleges. So I want to see the college acceptance rates increasing each and every year. All the things that make for what any good school would actually be looking for, but I think more broadly, I think politically, what I think about is seeing this issue being stated as a crisis. I think you have to affirmatively call it what it is first by the powers that be, and I think that's why the work of the mayor is so important, because he's calling the question, right? And he's stating this as an issue. And an issue that needs to be dealt with by everyone, because no one single entity is going to come up with the answer to this. But if it is at least stated unequivocally as politically as a real issue, I think that will inspire continued philanthropic support and others who are, you know, will come to the table to say we need to do something about this. And I think in many ways that's the first response that we have to have. My good friend Jeff Canada always says, you know, we're saving our young people by the hundreds, but we're losing them by the thousands. And so you'll never catch up. You can point to a Harlem Children's Zone. You can point to an Eagle Academy. We're still islands of success. But the condition will not change unless you have many more people at the table who are committed, who care, and are committed to actually making a difference. And so to me, that's the first thing that really, and the biggest thing that has to happen is that it's stated as a political issue that we all need to come to the table on. And I think if you don't get it from a social, moral standpoint, we need to come to it from an economic standpoint. That this is so much wasted human capital that we are economically spending so much money to incarcerate that it just makes no sense. And you can spend for a fraction of that cost, you can educate them properly and educate these young people properly and have them in this mix and in this game as we are in this global competitive race. You've got to see it from one side or the other.
I'd be curious to hear the response to the question, well, why black boys? Why boys of color? What about girls? What about Latino girls? There are so many other populations that are in need, and why this targeted strategy? And how do you? I'm sure you get that question. How do you respond to that?
I mean, from the city's perspective, I think, the data points you there on every single indicator. Boys of color are faring worse, sometimes, and most of the time, dramatically worse. And there's something in a lot of the issues that we're talking about that comes out of the confluence of race and gender. And I think that's an important point to mm-hmm. make. So some of these questions that we're dealing with, it's not just about communities of color, it's not just about boys, it's about that combination.
Yep.
That makes it particularly both a challenging issue, but that also is the source, I think, of some of the challenges that we're now seeking to address. So, mm-hmm. You could certainly make an argument for focusing on other populations, and I think there are places, for example, in government that are programs geared towards and other. I think the scope of the challenge around boys of color is so significant that the mayor felt that this required this level of focus and attention.
I just want to add. I would add to that something that David said earlier in the conversation, which is that I think if we, as a city, as a state, as a country, are able to make the type of meaningful investments in profoundly different life chances for boys of color, what will have happened is an investment in a system of education and social support which would benefit all vulnerable children in the country. On the topic of rising that, lifting that boat, if this country with its history of racism, with its particular relationship with African American males, can make headway there, our systems of social supports will look differently and they'll look better.
Any other questions out there? Hold your thought, Richard, and...
There you go. Hi, I'm Suzanne Lim with the Department of Youth and Community Development. And I don't know if it's a question. I think it's more of an observation, and that is that I understand the emphasis on really young children, because as David said, the younger you can get them in to your school or your program, the greater the chance of success. I think, and that makes a lot of sense, but, unless we're willing to throw away generations that are older, we have to also invest in second chance programs. And DYCD has a number of programs aimed at disconnected youth. And if you look at the disconnected youth population, you get a lot of young men of color in there. And... a lot of the programs that we have, that they're not framed as programs aimed at young men of color, but in fact we're capturing. There's some of a lot of our disconnected youth employment programs, actually, we found to our surprise, were attracting equal numbers or slightly more numbers of young men than young women, which is not usual in the social services world. So we knew we were onto something when we started offering subsidized jobs programs that was something that young men could understand, and young men who maybe had gone down a wrong path, maybe they had been incarcerated and were trying to turn their lives around. And work is something that everybody understands. They understand the value of it. And I guess I'm just arguing for, let us not forget as we talk about capturing the really young boys, that we also need to think about second chance programs for older men.
Thank you. Richard, you want to make a comment?
It was a thought that I was going to be upset if I left without saying, you know, largely because I have a room full of captive audience of funders who have to listen to me for a few minutes. You know, I think that there are some, really on the topic of partnership, there are some very particular things that I would hope that the philanthropic community would do more of and commit to help advance this issue. And some of them we've already discussed. But one is particularly around advocacy and continuing to be advocates yourselves, for funders to be advocates for this issue, but also to invest in organizations that are doing advocacy. You know, right now we're looking at a city budget, which would, I'm sorry, I'm looking at you, Bill, because I'm normally crying to you about this stuff. Yes, because your name is always on the letter. we're looking at a city budget, for example, which would cut the capacity of the OST system in half from its peak, which would devastate the early childhood system. These things hurt black boys. And so from my perspective, you have a city which is at odds with itself. We have commission, which is doing work to advance the cause of black boys, and in the same hand is gutting systems that provide core safety, emotional, educational supports to those very same young boys. So when we talk about how do you move a needle and how do you end poverty in New York City, it will be because ultimately advocates applying pressure to elected officials to change the way we do business. So I would encourage everyone, folks who are serious about this challenge in finding real meaningful solutions, to invest in advocacy. I also, you know, the importance of continuing to invest in new program models. You know, I private dollars is what helps new ideas germinate. Our African American Nail Initiative, which is a young program and a small program, is funded all by private dollars. And it's just always important to recognize that, you know, we need philanthropists who are willing to take risks. Particularly when it comes to intractable, whatever the word is, problems such as this, we need philanthropists who are willing to take risks and invest in new ideas. I also wanted to say that I think our field needs to invest in African-American leaders in the social service sector and educational sector, because I do believe that one of the things which will keep these problems first and foremost in our minds is people like you and your job, and you and your job, and me and my job. And unless we are really developing the next generation of leaders, we're not going to have that. And I just want to finally make a plea that one of the things that we can do is to continue to talk straightforwardly about the continuing role and importance that racism plays in our lives and our societies. And that's one reason why it's important to talk about black boys, I think, mm-hmm. because it's important to talk about race. And the ways in which race gets at children everywhere in every part of their lives. Mm-hmm. Just in foster care, you know, we are a big part of the city's foster care system. We know that people of color and black people are disproportionately represented at every stage in the foster care system, from reports to substantiated cases to having children being pulled from their homes. And we know the tremendously negative results that young people face in foster care. And this is all controlling for income, controlling for every other factor, even knowing that the research suggests that black families, in fact, contrary to every stereotype in the world, are less likely to engage in physical abuse of their children than white families. And you go through you go through system to system, problem to problem. We know that race plays a big role. We have to be able and willing to talk about that and invest in those strategies which are looking to take racism head on.
Great, thank you, Rich. Use the mic. Where's the mic? Throw him the mic.
You have a question?
It would be helpful process, Sean.
Thank you.
So it would be helpful if you could talk to us about what works. I think one of the major challenges many years ago when we started this discussion, it was just about boys. It was about boys weren't coming to programs, boys were dropping out of school, boys were not attending after school programs in the same levels. They just weren't coming. Now we hear that it's not cool if you're a kid who's dropped out of school. It's not, it is a lot of peer pressure not to walk into a site and ask for help. It's not helpful. It's not good. You're not seen as being a cool in your community if you seek help. Enrollment is down across the board in terms of males, just males, not black males, not Latino males, Hispanic males. What works? I mean, what are you doing differently in your school, David and Rich, that's getting young men to come in? And what are the percentages? It might help answer this question about what works in a short term. I mean, we struggle with this question. We not only struggle with that question, we struggle with the question of why black boys over why Latino males or Hispanic males, or particularly any male who's either native born or who's spent time in this, whose family has been in this country for generations. They fail miserably across. So that, just trying to understand who is we're trying to figure out answers to. And how do you just get them in the door? How are you keeping them in the door? That's maybe one of the indicators. In the short term, you have a room full of funders that are struggling with this issue across every conceivable sector, whether it's foster care, juvenile justice, youth development, or workforce.
Right.
Those are the four big ones.
Sure.
Particularly on the fatherhood one. I think, you know, they're just some easy, we think, I mean, we've heard there's some easy things to do. But what are you doing to get them in the door? What are you doing to keep them in the door? What are you doing that matters, that makes your programs win?
You know, it's an interesting question. I think it goes to something that Rich just said as well, which is about, it's almost about like, well, who's carrying the message? You know, you can have the doors open and we can all be impressed with all the things that we've got ready for them, and yet nobody's walking through the door. A critical lever in all that is, who is messaging to them that the door is open? That's very, very important. It has to be someone, and I, you know, quote unquote, right, who they understand, who they think really gets them. Because that same notion, Sean, what you asked, that same question about, you know, why black boys, when you flip it, the black boys say the same thing, right? But they say, you know, why us? Why does it seem like we've been the forgotten ones? Why are we the ones that are studied like we're a different species or something? You know, we're studied over and over and all the research and at the end of the day, they're just like everybody else. It's a deeper political question that has, you know, probably racism at its core. And so this issue about opportunities that are there to help them is really about trust. Because you have a population of people who are drowning, and when you throw the life raft to them, they question, well, what is your motive? What's in it for you? What are you doing? And you're saying, well, what are you talking about? You're drowning. Grab the rope, right? But they've been used to so many people just kind of seemingly taking advantage of them, otherwise disappointing them in the end. And so there's that issue of trust. When I would ask the young men, why did you choose to come to Eagle Academy? You know, overwhelmingly, the answer that I would get more than anything else was, and they wouldn't say it to you publicly, they'd say it behind the scenes very sheepishly, I heard that this is a place that I could get a mentor. Now, we thought mentor, as I mentioned this earlier, right? I thought mentoring would be a good thing to do. I mean, who a good mentoring program we'd all agree with. But I, again, had no idea how just profoundly impactful it really is for young men who are growing up in a hip-hop generation. A hip-hop generation is a fatherless generation. Young men who have begun to create their own definition of manhood in the absence of men, right? And then we blame them because they got it wrong. Mm-hmm. And so what are we doing? We're standing in the gap. When they come to a place and they see men, right? We've got all the women there as well, but they've always had the women. They've always had mom and grandma and auntie and Miss Williams, my first grade teacher, and Miss Jackson, my fifth grade teacher. The women have always been there in the lives for these young men. What's been missing are the men. And what that means in their overall social emotional development, you can't even it's so significant that you have to invest in that kind of bridging the gap for it to make a difference. Part of what we do in our mentoring training is we show the video that was done on 60 Minutes. Dan Rather did a piece several years ago on these elephants in South Africa. And it was an overpopulation of elephants. And the government's response to deal with this burgeoning population was to kill the male bull elephants. They killed the daddies to slow the population. And the unintended consequence of that action was the killing of the rhinos. Now, you know the rhinos and the elephants, they all live in the same space. And the people who were charged with, you know, staying on top of everything couldn't figure out why these rhinos were showing up dead. And they did the research and they studied and they figured out, using this ultra-red, in the evenings, the young male bull elephants, not the females, the young male elephants were killing the rhinos. They did not understand what it meant to be an elephant in the absence of the daddy elephants to show them. So it's a pretty amazing study when you think about it. And so the government's ultimate response was to take these male bull elephants from another part of the country and bring them in. And almost overnight, the situation changed. How profound is that? And when we talk to our young men, overwhelmingly that's what you get. This yearning for that responsible male to show them and lead them on that journey to becoming a man. Makes all the difference in the world. Of course you have to have great teachers. You need all the basic elements of a good school that any good school needs. But then there's some other pieces that you have to have. You've got to teach young men about how to work together. They love to compete. Young men love to compete, but not necessarily one-on-one. They like to compete, my group against your group. You have to understand that and how to build that into your overall curriculum and the activities that you do in school. Keeping them off the streets after school. We keep them in school for an additional 2 to 3 hours a day. We keep them in school every Saturday for 3 to 4 hours. Our parents love it, right? And it's not just about the extra English or math or social studies. We do all that, the additional tutoring that for those who need it. But it's about the basketball. It's about debate, chess, robotics, all the things. It's a boys' club. And when you understand the energy and the mindset of boys, that's what we're doing that I think is making such a difference, and the reason people are visiting us from all around the world now is because we figured some things out about what makes boys tick, and then we build that stuff into our overarching program.
We have about 5 minutes of time for one question before I'm going to give panelists an opportunity to take a minute with a closing statement. Any more questions? No. We're going to ask each of you, in a minute, tell us in the work that you're engaged in and about to launch, what does winning look like? How will you know that you're winning in this work?
For this initiative, I think formally getting it off the ground would be a big, big winning. But I think getting to the question of if a year from now agencies are coming together and they're producing data on both their programs and their services, and we're actually looking at how young men of color are faring as a city government, then I think that will be that will be success. In the process, I think if the mayor's effort inspires other localities to not just address this issue by setting up one boutique program, you know, that they do a lot of press around, but don't dig into. If it inspires other municipalities to dig into all of this mess, which means looking at their own agencies, looking at their policies, then I think that'll be success. And, you know, I mean, to Rich's point, I mean, I can give you a million ways in which we're at conflict. And that's difficult, but that's not a reason not to probe and not to try this. And maybe the hope is instead of just taking on one way or one side, you know, just advocating against that, perhaps through initiatives like these, by focusing on the population, it will become so apparent mm-hmm. what we need to do, that it'll be harder for those programs to be the first on the block. I don't know. That's wishful thinking, which is against my nature, but I'm hoping that that's an outcome. So that's what we're trying to do, I think.
Sure. I think it's very easy for us to define what winning is. Winning is when every child that enters our programs, we can say with confidence that that child will graduate from college at age 21, 22, prepared to enter the world as a full citizen, fully able to engage, fully able to live the life of their dream. That's what success looks like. And when by doing that work, we are a beacon for others who would hope to accomplish that work as well. Well, I say that knowing that that means that winning is unlikely, and it's unlikely anytime soon. And I think in many ways for an organization full of people, you know, I get to work with such wonderful people, but people who in their hearts want to help children, establishing that as victory is difficult because we know that with the children we serve, including children who are coming home from jail, who are in the foster care system, and children who are experiencing abject levels of poverty, we know that we're going to fail a lot of those children. But I do think it's critically important that we define victory as nothing less. Otherwise we'll stop, and we can't stop until all the children are safe.
We are we're getting ready to expand into Newark, New Jersey, and I don't know how many of you are investing in Newark or doing work in Newark in some way, shape, or form, and I've had so many people caution me about going to Newark, New Jersey. They've said, as tough as it is in New York City, you're in for a rude awakening in Newark. Newark has levels of dysfunction that are generational and are so deep very difficult to claim victory. And so those are all the reasons that we're continuing to go to Newark. Because ultimately, unless you make a real investment in this, the condition won't change. Poverty is it's not an activity for us to be involved in, right? Reducing poverty, that's a lifelong systemic commitment, and we have to be engaged in that. And part of that, as our former Chancellor Joel Klein used to say, was that we've got to be very focused on changing what's happening with young people in schools each and every day. And so, you know, for me, victory is, reduction in violence. You know, these young people and young men in particular who are just shooting and killing each other on a daily basis. To see that reduced and to see that go away, increasing the graduation rates. I mean, that's a very practical performance metric that we can look at. Can we, in fact, increase the amount of young people who are graduating from our high schools? I ultimately think the part of the strategy that we need to engage in is eliminating middle schools, which I think are a disaster. I think that educational wasteland in this country is part of the reason why we decided to make the Eagle Model grade 6 through 12, which is to essentially take young people all the way through and not hand them off. That transition, I think, is very, very problematic, not only here in New York, but across the country. And so victory to me means these young people no longer the canary in the mine, that we do in fact change the conditions that produce that toxic environment, and that you just see healthy, wonderful young men who fit right into the fabric of everybody else. They're no longer looked at in any special way. They're just like everybody else. You know, Sean, you pointed out early on an article that inspired you. And when it is, I read an article several years ago, and the title of the article said, "Do Black Men Even Matter?" I mean, I don't know how as a conscious black man you read that and not be moved to some kind of action. And so that has always stayed in my head as a source of inspiration, really, for me and the work that I'm trying to do. But it cannot happen without everybody on board and those who are in positions philanthropically to get more involved. I think supporting initiatives like the Young Men's Initiative that Andrea is leading, you know, Children's Aid Society, so they can expand on that work that they're doing, and organizations like Eagle, we're not the only ones, but organizations like that are actually out there that are making some headway, but need to be fortified in order to really, really lead the way. You can't get all the results that you're looking for without the support. And so those are the things that I think that is that it's going to take to really make a huge and significant impact.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to thank all of the panelists for carving out time in their busy schedules to come join us. You helped us make history. This is our first ever Youth Funders or member meeting. And we want to just thank you for helping us keep this issue at the center of the philanthropic conversation. And I think how this particular meeting came about, I know that I participated in the first, I'm new to the steering committee, and I think in January's meeting, I said, well, it might be a good idea to have a member meeting. And forgot that when you kind of make a recommendation in a meeting, it's thrown in your court. But thank God for Toya Williford, who said, you know, I will partner with you and Janet, Sean, to make sure that this happens. And so she really kind of drove and pushed this to make sure that our member meeting would happen. And I want to ask Toya to come on up and say a few closing remarks. You are on the agenda.
Did you forget your cash?
let's give the panelists a round of applause. Thank you.
So I will be brief. I just wanted to thank everyone so much for coming. As Sean said, this is our first member meeting. We hope to do this on an annual basis, and it's a great way to bring our community together, share ideas, learn what's happening in the field, and really put what we know into practice. It's all about collaboration. We have to continue to work together. I'm very passionate about the work that I do with youth, and I'm sure you guys all know that because I go out kind of full bore. But again, just thank you so much. Thank you to our panelists. Please stay and network and talk and continue to build and strengthen our community. And there's food here. That's it.